Chairman, in the case of United States versus Campbell.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This is a case, put simply, where the military judge made the right ruling with regard to whether the charges were unreasonably multiplied, but erred by failing to consider the appropriate remedy, which in this case would have been dismissal of charges 1 and 3. The military judge correctly found that the charges were unreasonably multiplied when he stated, "I do believe that all three offenses essentially arose out of the same transaction and were part of the same impulse." Where the military judge erred was when he failed to consider dismissal as an appropriate remedy after findings. The military judge foreshadowed this failure when the motion was taken up prior to trial, in which he said he would reconsider the motion after findings.
In your view, is both the multiplicity and multiplication issue before this court?
No, Your Honor, simply the unreasonable multiplication of charges.
How do you have a single impulse that lasts 28, that goes 28 times over 3 months?
Well, Your Honor, that's an excellent question, but the prosecution chose to charge us as diverse occasions, but each time it occurred, it was part of the same transaction and was part of the same impulse.
How?
But because, Your Honor, as the military judge said, that he found that the false official statement was part of, he said, essentially part of the larceny, in that the false official statement, or a false pretense, if you will, was required.
Is it larceny by false pretense?
Yes, Your Honor. As the trial defense counsel noted after receiving the government's response to their motion prior to trial, they realized that the theory of the government's case was this was larceny by false pretenses. So essentially, the false official statement, if you will, was really the false pretense in order to obtain the items, in this case, the Vicodin and Percocet. And that was the second aspect of the larceny, the taking aspect, which was what the subsequent possession.
The bonus aspertatus.
Yes, Your Honor. And as the military judge also noted, there was no actual evidence of possession independent of simply the fact that information was put into the Pyxis machine and the Vicodin.
Okay, well then to follow up on the chief judge's question, where's the prejudice? He did this 28 times and he got a naked dismissal. Where's the prejudice?
Your Honor, the prejudice is in the fact that he has multiple convictions for what was essentially one transaction. As this court noted in Roderick, that is prejudice, the fact that Roderick had multiple convictions for what was essentially the same offense. So, and as this court stated in Roderick and as the Supreme Court stated in Ball, having multiple convictions, even as the Supreme Court said in Ball, if the sentence run concurrently, is still prejudice because of the fact that multiple convictions can have an impact in terms of collateral consequences. And for this particular appellant.
Well, counsel, didn't you answer the chief judge's question that this is not a multiplicity case?
Yes, Your Honor.
In a civilian society, you typically have someone convicted of two or three discrete offenses, and then the judge will sentence them to a concurrent sentence.
Understood, Your Honor.
Isn't the rule for courts-martial dealing with the unreasonable multiplication of charges for sentencing analogous to concurrent sentencing? In other words, he says, you do have three separate and distinct offenses here. They're not multiplicious for multiplicity analysis, but I'm going to treat them as being unreasonable multiplication as far as sentencing.
Correct, Your Honor. Rule for Court-Martial 1003, that is a possibility, and ironically, the actual title of that is multiplicity, even though it's not multiplicity in a double jeopardy sense. But there's also Rule for Court-Martial 307C4.
But the Supreme Court was concerned about it in the double jeopardy sense, weren't they?
Yes, Your Honor, in the double jeopardy sense. But as this Court has stated in Roderick and also in Quiroz, there's the separate legal concept of unreasonable multiplication of charges, which is as a question of law, as a question of reasonableness. Was there prosecutorial overreaching in creative drafting of the charges by taking what was essentially one transaction and one impulse and making it into a variety of separate offenses?
Aren't you conflating multiplicity for findings, if such a thing exists, and UM?
No, Your Honor, I disagree. What we're saying is that where the military judge erred is he found unreasonable multiplication of charges, but then...
Well, you're assuming that. Is finding substantially one transaction, end quote, equal to finding unreasonable multiplication, or is it a multiplicity finding?
Well, Your Honor, It's unreasonable multiplication of charges.
How so?
Because the military judge, prior to trial, ruled on the multiplicity motion that was before him and stated that, I find that there is no multiplicity here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's unreasonable multiplication of charges. And to go back to your earlier question, the situation is that, as this court stated in Quiroz and followed up in Pauling, you have the five-factor test in determining whether there is, in fact, unreasonable multiplication of charges. Once you do that, once the court does that, the appropriate next step, if there is, in fact, a determination that there's unreasonable multiplication of charges, is to determine the appropriate remedy. As this court said in Quiroz, when discussing the lower court's admonition to practitioners to avoid using the phrase multiplicious for sentencing, this court said we find no issue with that because there may be times when the remedy is more appropriately fashioned in regards to sentencing, and thereby left open that the fact that you've...
Okay, at trial you say the judge properly found unreasonable multiplication. Was there any objection to his statement of what the maximum sentence was?
There was no objection, Your Honor, but the...
Where does that leave you?
The military judge didn't give the parties an opportunity to object either. He simply said that based upon the court's ruling, I calculate the maximum punishment as being 5 years.
What do you mean? Was he supposed to invite objection? Was counsel glued to his seat?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, well then I don't see the relevance of that.
But they simply agreed that based upon his ruling that the maximum punishment was 5 years.
Well, then where does that leave you? Waive it?
It leaves us right where we were before, Your Honor, because the problem was not in the fact that the military judge chose the remedy of merging the charges for purposes of sentencing. It's that the military judge failed to consider, once findings were announced, that he had before him the opportunity to dismiss the charges at that point. In that regard, it's very similar to what the trial judge in Roderick did, where the trial judge in Roderick stated, I don't have the ability to dismiss charges. I can't
take that. Judge didn't say that, though.
No, Your Honor.
There's nothing on the record suggesting that he thought that he was limited in that respect, is there?
There is, Your Honor. That's when the military judge...
Point me to the page in the JA.
Yes, Your Honor. It's I believe it's at Joint Appendix 33. Let me verify that, Your Honor. Excuse me, 31, Your Honor. And what he says, Your Honor, was that I'm not going to take up this issue now prior to hearing evidence, which we would agree is the correct approach because he has not heard the evidence, and as he states, it could play out in a variety of different ways. He then says that, but however, based upon what evidence does come forth here, at the court-martial, I will determine whether or not the charges are an unreasonable multiplication of charges for sentencing purposes. And by that language, the military judge is foreclosing the possibility of dismissal as a remedy once findings are announced. And because the military judge...
So by implication, you're saying he thought he was so limited?
Yes, Your Honor, because the military judge never definitively says, I deny your motion or I grant your motion or anything to that effect. He just simply says, here we are in the motions hearing. I'm not going to take up this issue until I hear some evidence on it. And once he does, he never again considers the possibility of dismissal. And by the language, and like you said, Your Honor, by implication in prior to trial, he says, I will take up this issue, but only for purposes of whether there's multiplication of charges for sentencing purposes. And that implication is, Your Honor, that once findings are announced by the members, he does not have the ability to then dismiss the unreasonably multiplied charges. So in that regard, it's a kind of a quasi-Roderick situation where that judge said, I have no authority to dismiss these charges at any point.
Did counsel ask for dismissal of charges?
Yes, Your Honor. They moved for dismissal. They filed their motion to dismiss prior to trial. Once they received, their written motion, they only asked for dismissal of charge 3, the possession charge. But upon receiving the government's response to their motion, and understanding what the government's actual theory of the case was, they orally amended that motion to also include the charge one, which was the false official statement charge.
Could the government have charged 28 counts of larceny?
That is in their discretion, Your Honor. They could do that.
So they could have done that. And in your view, that might have been a multiplication of charges?
That could be an issue, yes, Your Honor.
But they could have done 28 counts of larceny?
They could have, yes, Your Honor.
Could you track the lineage of single impulse and transaction? Where does that come from?
I believe it comes from Kiraj, Your Honor, in that talking about that, and it's similar to in the conceptual.
Well, it goes back to the 1969 manual, but do you care to, what value does it have? Is it binding? What is it? I'm still stuck on what it means and how it applies to something taking place over 3 months of time.
Yes, Your Honor. And what I was going to say is that conceptually it goes even further back. It goes back to Colonel Winthrop's treatise in the 1920s, talking about that what essentially is one offense should not be turned into multiple charges. And prior to 1969, it was actually in the manual for court-martial. I believe it was the 1984 manual for court-martial when the language was actually moved to the discussion section. But this court.
So one offense, and you just said that they could have charged it as 28 different counts.
They could have, Your Honor, and there still could be an unreasonable multiplication of charges issue.
You don't think it's possible to read this record to very almost clearly state that the military judge found that there was not an unreasonable multiplication of charges for purposes of findings, and but then he later found that there was an unreasonable multiplication for purposes of sentencing, which is exactly what he then did in terms of treating it that way. I mean, he says on pages 30 and 31, there isn't an unreasonable multiplication, and he's not going to dismiss one of the charges because of the three different ways that the thing could play out for contingencies of proof.
Well, we respectfully disagree, Your Honor. What we believe the military judge
so
is saying.
So you don't agree that it's possible to read the record that way, or you don't agree that that's the way that you would read the record?
I would disagree, Your Honor. I think what the record states is I'm not taking up this motion now because I haven't heard any evidence on it. So it's not that he's making a ruling. He says I'm deferring. And again, as we would say, he says he defers. And when he intends to take up the motion again post-findings, if there was a finding of guilty as to two or more offenses, he would then consider whether or not the charges were unreasonably multiplied for sentencing purposes, and noticeably absent from that is I will take up the issue as to whether they're unreasonably multiplied for findings purposes. And as we discussed previously, the implication is he's failed to consider that possibility because he did not believe that he had that remedy available to him once findings were announced.
Counsel, I'm still a little confused as to what the military judge actually did. You're taking the position that his ruling was based on unreasonable multiplication of charges. But in doing that, the explanation that he gave for it was that they essentially arose from the same transaction and were part of the same impulse. That language comes from RCM 1003C13, which is a multiplicity provision. And it is not from the Clouseau case, which has five factors that he did not mention. So the rationale for his decision was multiplicity, not unreasonable multiplication of charges. So what are we dealing with here? Do we really know?
In terms of what the issue of law is, Your Honor?
As to what the military judge based his finding upon, whether it was a multiplicity finding or whether it was unreasonable multiplication of charges.
Oh, admittedly, Your Honor, his findings of fact and conclusions of law were very thin. The fact that he stated prior to trial that he was denying the multiplicity motion leaves us with that he's talking about unreasonable multiplication of charges. The fact that he found unreasonable multiplication of charges but did not consider dismissal as a possible remedy once he made that finding after findings by the members were announced is the error, and that's where he abused his discretion.
So assuming that we're looking at this from a de novo perspective, what should we do?
Dismiss charges 1 and 3, Your Honor.
Based on
the fact that the military judge abused his discretion.
But if we dismiss them, we're dismissing them based on multiplicity or based on unreasonable multiplication of charges?
Unreasonable multiplication of charges, Your Honor.
Isn't merging
the Clouseau test?
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't merging a standard recipe for multiplicity?
It is, Your Honor. And again, it's not that he did that. It's that he failed to consider dismissal.
No. Now, I'm going back to Judge Erdman's question. What is this? What is this creature? He merged it for sentencing. Isn't that a traditional remedy for multiplicity for sentencing purposes?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay.
Isn't that what he asked? I mean, isn't that what the defense counsel asked for in the alternative at the JA page 23? The focus is on his actions as alleged, so even if the court finds there is no multiplicity for findings, the defense requests the offenses be found multiplicious for sentencing.
Yes, Your Honor, they did ask for that.
So why exactly are we here?
It doesn't change the fact that he failed to consider dismissal as a remedy after findings were announced. It's the fact that, in a way, you could almost say that the trial defense counsel was cutting their losses with the judge who seemed to be indicating prior to trial that he was not, did not think that he had that remedy available to him once findings were announced. And I see my time is almost up. Are there any further questions from the court? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Linnell Latendra, and along with Colonel Don Christensen, we represent the United States in this matter. The appellant in this case waived the issue when he abandoned his right at trial. And even if this court finds that there was no waiver, there was no unreasonable multiplication of charges. But before we get to those issues, we must first address the question raised by this panel. Why are we here? Or as Judge Stuckey asked, what is this? What this is a military judge who first, in response to Judge Ryan's question, understood that dismissal was an option. We know that by looking very clearly at the record on both pages 30 to 31. The military judge started out this discussion by indicating on lines 3 through 5 that he understood that dismissal was an option, both in terms of the multiplicity motion as well as the unreasonable multiplication of charges motion. He went on to explain, after he had found that there was no multiplicity in this case, he went on to explain that at this point in time, he was not going to dismiss the charges, and in essence said that he would reconsider and defer this motion, the unreasonable multiplication of charges motion, until after findings, at which time he indicated that he would reconsider that being the options of either dismissing the case, or dismissing a charge, or of merging them for sentencing purposes. So what happened after findings? After findings, it is clear that the appellant changed his mind. We're not exactly clear why or how, because the record is silent as to that. But what is clear, on page 32 of the joint appendix, the military judge questions the defense counsel and says, quote, on lines 19 through 20, you kind of amended your position. And from that moment in time forward, the only discussion that was being held was about multiplicity for sentencing. Now, the government fully recognizes that at one point during this discussion, the military judge used the word unreasonable multiplication for sentencing. But what is clear from the context of the discussion by both trial counsel, the discussion by appellant's counsel, and the discussion and the terms of art used by the military judge was that the only question remaining before the court was multiplicity for sentencing. They were using language out of RCM. In fact, the defense counsel, appellant's counsel, made it very clear on page 34 of the joint appendix, line 5, sir, this is under RCM 1003. At that point in time, the military judge was considering multiplicity for sentencing purposes, and that is the only finding that was made at the trial court level. Furthermore, the government asserts that the appellant actually waived this issue that has been petitioned to this court. He waived it because it is clear from the record that appellant amended his position. He amended his position by abandoning his position and moving to one of multiplicity for sentencing, not unreasonable multiplication of charges. And when an appellant has waived, whether waived on the record or through abandonment, as in this case, his right as to that issue, his appeal right, has been extinguished and should not be considered by this court. Even if we were to find, or this panel were to find, that the issue was not waived, it is clearly not unreasonable multiplication of charges. And we know that by going through the Quorum's factors. First, as this court well knows, unreasonable multiplication of charges is a doctrine of reasonableness. And we must look at how the prosecution acted in charging this case. As the Chief Judge pointed out, and the appellant concedes, the prosecution could have charged this in 28 different specs. Quite frankly, they could have charged 28 different specs under three different charges, but they did not do so. And when we look through the five different factors laid out by Quorum, it is quite clear that there is no unreasonable multiplication of charges. First, the appellant, although he did object at trial, he later abandoned that objection and abandoned that issue altogether. Hence, we actually have a waiver of this issue. Second, is each charge and specification aimed at a distinctly separate criminal act? And in this case, it clearly is. First, charge one under Article 107, we have a false official statement, an attempt to gain access to this.
Can you make a false official statement to a machine?
Yes, Your Honor, in this case you can.
How?
What he was doing, the appellant was doing, is he approached this machine, he had to swipe in, use its fingerprints, and then he inputted into the machine that a doctor had ordered him to put in a prescription for a patient. Similarly to making a false official statement.
Is that a false official statement, or is that just larceny by false pretenses? He got the stuff out of the machine under false pretenses. Where's the false official statement come in?
Well, Your Honor, it comes in because of how the UCMJ handles larceny by false official pretense. And how Congress has determined that we should look at larceny is not under the common law definition, where we did look at larceny by false official pretense. But instead, as this court determined in Antonelli, the Congress has determined that we just need to prove an intent to permanently deprive under Article 121. And as such, you can have both a false official statement and a larceny as two separate and distinct acts and crimes in this case.
Sounds like the judge's one transaction analysis that you're making.
Well, Your Honor, he was making that determination under multiplicity for sentencing.
Was the false official statement linked to the larceny, or was there a separate reason to charge a false official statement here?
There are separate reasons, Your Honor. First, there are separate consequences to the actions of the false official statement. For example, one of the victims of this case was a woman whose medical records were falsified when the appellant went in and said she has been prescribed this narcotic. And when she went to try to refill her prescription, she was denied that medication.
Then in your response to Judge Stuckey, you were talking about larceny by false pretenses. So which was the government's theory?
It was a larceny by false pretenses. However, Your Honor, we did not have to, although they're talking about that false pretenses is not an element or requirement to prove up under larceny. The element of larceny was intent to deprive. And how do we know intent to deprive? Well, there's something unique about the Pyxis machine here. And what that is that the appellant could have actually returned the drugs. He could have actually made the false official statement by saying that he was ordered a prescription by a doctor, which was false. He could have come into the possession of these narcotics in violation of 112A, and then he could have returned them. There is actually a button on the Pyxis machine, as was explained to the court members, where he could have returned the drugs and not committed the larceny. It is that separate act, that intent to permanently deprive.
Did the government charge him with false a false official statement because he put another put a patient at jeopardy based on the medical records indicating that the patient had received the medicine, or did the government charge him because he committed the larceny?
The government charged the three specifications separately and argued that each contained a separate criminal act. They actually charged it on diverse occasions for those false official statements, so we didn't actually name the specific victims, although their medical records were before the trier of fact.
And the second criminal act with respect to the false statement was what?
Well, each time the appellant went forward, he had to falsify a prescription order from a doctor in order to obtain these drugs.
And the societal interest there was what?
In charging the false official statement, Your Honor, the societal interest is that RNs, emergency room nurses, should not be falsifying documents and medical records on behalf of stating that a doctor ordered him to prescribe narcotics. This occurred not only with the woman who was not able to obtain her medication. He falsified the documents on a 9-year-old girl's medical records stating that she too had been prescribed these narcotics, as well as a master sergeant in the Air Force who was actually allergic to the very medication that he falsified.
If he pushed the button and dumped the drugs back in, could the government have charged him with wrongful appropriation?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe they could have. They couldn't have charged with larceny because he didn't
permanently deprive. There was evidently no intent to permanently deprive, but of course wrongful appropriation doesn't need that.
Yes, Your Honor, and when looking at the Quorum factors, it is very clear that it is within the government's discretion to do just that. For example, this court in United States versus Pauling looked at two specifications of forgery. In that transaction, what the appellant did is he forged the name of the drawer's signature on the front side of the check, and on the reverse side of four checks, he also forged his wife's name as the endorser. This court found that that was not unreasonable multiplication of charges because these were two distinct crimes and met the definition under Juarez, specifically factor three. In both Pauling and in this court's case in Anderson, the court also looked to the issue of how did the prosecution charge. Separate and apart from Juarez factor five, how did the government charge? And they looked at this notion that when there were 16 checks in Pauling, and as opposed to making 16 separate specifications, they merged them into one, that was aired in the government, that found in the government's favor, that there was not any sort of unreasonable overreaching on the part of the government. This court in Anderson also noted that in the attempted communication of intelligence to the enemy, to suspected terrorists, that the government could have actually charged every email, every internet posting, every blog entry, but instead charged them on diverse occasions. That is what we have here, that the government reasonably combined 28 separate instances of lying, committing the false official statement, of then possessing the 112A under 112A, and then committing larceny. What the appellant is arguing is that multiple convictions equals prejudice, and they would have this court look to its decision in Roderick, United States versus Roderick. But Roderick is very distinguishable from this case. First and foremost, in Roderick, the military judge stated on the record that he had no authority to dismiss the convictions under an unreasonable multiplication of charges. That was clearly not the case here. But also the charging themselves was very different. In Roderick, you had an appellant who took pictures of his daughter as child pornography pictures. And he was charged in one case with indecent liberties with a minor. And in a second charge, under incorporation of 18 U.S.C. 2251A, by using a minor to create sexually explicit photographs. These were essentially the exact same action. The only difference is one had to be in interstate commerce, and the other had to gratify or satisfy his sexual, was done with the purpose of satisfying his sexual desires. But it was the same act. That is entirely different from what we have here. We have three separate steps that the appellant went through in order to first falsify the medical records, second to possess a narcotic under violation of Article 112A, and finally to commit larceny.
Counsel, Probably my ignorance from having not sat on the court for a few years, but had the judge granted the original motion and dismissed two of these three charges before any proof came in or anything, wouldn't that have been an abuse of discretion that the government could have appealed under Article 62?
I believe so, Your Honor. Absolutely.
Because they're not multiplicious for findings, are they?
Correct. And the judge determined that they were not multiplicious for findings.
Well, what gives him the authority to dismiss them after findings? If he can't dismiss them before findings because they're not multiplicious, what gives him the authority to do it after findings? Is that the jurisprudence of the court now?
It is, under RCM 907.
907?
Yes, sir. Okay. And so under that RCM, as well as under this court's decision in Roderick, that the unreasonable multiplication of charges can be remedied by either dismissal or by then later.
Well, and how have we defined the term unreasonable?
Well, we looked at unreasonable by looking at, and this court has used, the five factors laid out in Quorez in order to, in an attempt to find whether or not there is unreasonableness on the part of the prosecution. And what the government, the fourth Quorez factor, has to do with the number of charges and specifications.
Yeah. Well, I always thought that case and that doctrine kind of went to the JAG school exercise where they give you a factual situation and you've got to come up with how many charges you possibly can out of that factual situation.
Absolutely. And, Your Honor, this is a perfect example of our JAGs not doing what they were taught in JAG school. And that is something that this court should look at, actually specifically, Your Honor, under the fifth factor under Quorez. Because not only did they merge them in terms of not separating them out into 28 different specifications, but we also know that they were being reasonable by what is not on the charge sheet. And
just for the out of interest, if they had charged 28 counts of larceny, 28 counts of false official statements, what would the government's view be as to multiplication of charges?
Under multiplicity for sentencing, I believe that the government probably should have agreed to merge for sentencing. The trial counsel at that time, based on
but you would not view
charged.
That as a unreasonable multiplication of charges to have charged this 28 times 3?
Not for purposes of unreasonable multiplication of charges.
In the government's view?
In the government's view. Now, certainly.
So in response to Judge Cox's question, can the government imagine a case that would ever be unreasonable?
Well, hopefully the trial counsel would have then agreed that for sentencing purposes, when we look at did these arise out of a single transaction or occurrence, that they would have agreed for combining things under multiplicity for sentencing under a more discretionary look under RCM 1003. But the government was fully within its right to charge each and every specification separately.
How valid are those concepts anymore, the single impulse in the same transaction? When we look at multiplicity now using the Teeter's element test, and there's no reference at all other than these comments in the manual that are just kind of a leftover from prior days, do they have any validity anymore?
Well, they have validity, I think, Your Honor, for in purposes of RCM 1003, but in terms of multiplicity for findings, as Your Honor points out under Teeter's, it is strictly a Blockberger analysis.
Would you agree that the test for multiplicity for findings and for sentencing is the same?
No, Your Honor. The multiplicity for findings is simply a Blockberger analysis, and even as this Court pointed out in Roderick, even though the difference of having one element being interstate commerce and another element being to satisfy sexual desires, even though it was literally the exact same thing, that was upheld under multiplicity. It was not a multiplicity issue. However, when we look at multiplicity for findings, the RCM 1003 in the discussion section points out.
Well, just take away the discussion section. Just look at the text.
Well, the test itself under RCM without simply talks about whether or not they are without the comments section. You're correct, sir. We don't have either the Teeter's analysis or the single transaction, but for the discussion section.
And at some point, this court left those concepts for multiplicity for findings and went to the Teeter's blockbuster test. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes, sir. In sum, the appellate here clearly waived the issue by affirmatively abandoning this issue after findings. And as such, is not his ability to raise this issue on appeal was extinguished. In looking at the Quores factors that we have gone through, the one that I would like to turn to briefly before my time concludes is something that was raised by the appellant in his brief. The appellant, in looking at this idea that convictions themselves can be prejudicial, talked about the idea that he's going to have to face his RN licensing board at some point in time, and that he's being erroneously charged with two extra convictions. The government's response to that is good. It is a good thing for this appellant to have to face his RN licensing board with all three of these convictions, because if we were to accept the appellant's view, the only thing he would have walked away from the trial court with is a single specification of larceny, which, and going before a nurse licensing board, is not indicative of what this appellant did. He falsified medical records by stating that a doctor had ordered narcotics. He then possessed narcotics in violation of Schedule 2 and 3 substances in violation of Article 112A. And then he chose to walk away and permanently deprive the government of its property. The charges here were reasonable. They meet all five of the Quores factors. And as such, this court should deny the appellant's requested relief.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. The appellant did not waive this issue on appeal. And when the government says the references the trial judge amending language, the trial judge, as we spoke before, was talking about how they added to their motion to dismiss charge one in addition to the writ motion, which was solely charge three. Judge Stuckey asked a question, was there a separate reason to charge a false official statement? I'll answer that question. For the government, it was yes. It was to increase the punitive exposure of the appellant from 1 year in a dismissal to 6 years in a dismissal.
Is that illegitimate?
Yes, Your Honor. It was a reasonable multiplication of charges to do that, to take the false pretense aspect of the larceny and charge it as an additional crime.
No, that's not what I'm asking. I'm saying is simply the motivation to increase exposure illegitimate.
In this case, yes, Your Honor, and again, that's one of the five factors that this court looks to in determining whether or not it was reasonable or unreasonable.
But the government argued during its part of the thing that it was addressed to a separate societal interest, which was society's interest in not having false records floating around in other patients' files.
Your Honor, we'd submit that is not before this court. Any aspect of this case before this court had nothing to do with the medical records. There were no misconduct that was charged relating to any medical records.
Counsel, you don't disagree that the members could have found appellant guilty of the Article 107 offense, a false official statement, and found that he did not have the intent to permanently deprive, and found him not guilty of the larceny offense.
That's
why isn't that enough for us to say multiplicity for Teeter's purposes is multiplicity for unreasonable multiplication of charges for findings?
Well, Your Honor, it's a separate analysis. The reasonableness aspect, as this court originally said.
But what I'm asking you is, if the members could have found him guilty of one offense and not of the other, why isn't that exactly the sort of contingencies of proof that makes it not an unreasonable multiplication of charges?
Because it's still prosecutorial overreaching, Your Honor. But the fact that they could have found that doesn't negate the fact that this was an attempt by the prosecution to.
What evidence do you have of that, other than the fact that there's different specifications? Do you have statements by the prosecution? Do you have anything tangible?
No, Your Honor. We simply have the fact that
there's three charges based on 28 different instances of each of the offenses.
Yes, Your Honor. What we have is a larceny by false pretenses case in which the maximum punitive exposure was 1 year of confinement and dismissal, and the government attempted to make it 11 years in a dismissal, which is a substantial increase in the punitive exposure. Another thing that Judge Stuckey asked about the government talked about returning the drugs, and Judge Stuckey followed up the question. The offense is complete at that point, so putting the drugs back, it would be wrongful appropriation. So that doesn't get around the fact that it was unreasonably multiplied. It would just be simply a different offense, Your Honor. The fact that it wouldn't be larceny at that point. Another thing, the government stated that the appellant would have this court believe that multiple convictions equals prejudice. The court, yes, appellant would have you believe that because that's exactly what this court said in Roderick, that multiple convictions equals prejudice. And lastly, to conclude, we would argue that this is, in fact, the JAG school pattern. For whatever reason, Congress has determined that the maximum punishment for larceny by false pretenses of military property of a value under $500 is only subject to 1 year of confinement and a dismissal in the case of an officer. So the government tried to increase that to 11 years of confinement and was successful partially in that it was increased to 5 years of confinement. And with that, unless there are any further questions, it concludes our argument.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks both counsel for your argument, and the case is submitted, and we will stand in recess until 20 past the hour. Thank you.
Court stands in recess until 10:01.